maybe what we can do in the last part of our session is just address some of the questions that came in advance of the session. The first question that came in was, question number one is, please explain why some scaffold or stem cell combinations are considered 361 tissues and others not. If the primary mode of action is structural and secondary is metabolic, is the product classified as a 361 tissue? And I believe, Dr. Lee, this might be a question for you.
Right, and I think I can answer this kind of I think it's a general question, really. It's more about, you know, what's the distinction between a 351, what we call 351 versus a 361 tissue. And the numbers, for those of you that are not familiar, just refers to the section of the PHSA Act that's describes the regulation of these products. So, you know, human tissues actually fall under you know, the biologic category of human cells, tissue, and tissue-based products, which we call HCTPs. And actually, there's a tiered risk-based approach to regulating these products, and it's actually, you know, it's written down in the 21 CFR Part 1271, and some of the references that I provided, I think, provide that in a little more detail. But in general, there's there are four specific criteria that we look at to distinguish what we would what would be regulated under Section 361 versus Section 351. And it's again, it's like, I don't want to say it's lower risk, but I think there's different kind of consideration for a 361 product versus 351. And you know, some of these can include, for example, if the product is minimally manipulated, they might be intended for homologous use, and let's see, there could be manufacturer consideration, whether it's combined with other regulated products. There's also considerations regarding systemic effects. So I think I would defer that all the details are actually provided in some of the references. And again, it's there are specific consideration that goes into whether certain products fall under 361 or 351.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Lee. Dr. Langer, are you open to answering questions as well?
Absolutely.
Okay. People are fascinated by your presentation. I have a question here. In terms of scar-blocking reagents slowly released from polymer, what reagents do you suggest using, and can you tell us a little bit about the mechanism for reducing the scar formation?
Well, I think there's different possible mechanisms. Some are just using more biocompatible polymers. Some are using pure polymers. And then in terms of reagents, I think things like steroids are one of the things that we've used, and some of them have worked better than others depending on exactly the chemistry.
Another comment came in, Dr. Langer, I think it's for you, about comments on chitosan as a pretty strong preclinical track record, but is there a concern about a foreign protein, especially in this case, an insect protein, in terms of immunogenicity?
Yeah, well, so that's also an interesting question. I didn't mention chitosan. People have used chitosan for different wound dressings. And I think there's some possibility that it might be able to be used as a scaffold. If it was going to be used, again, as an encapsulating agent along the lines of alginate, I would still be concerned whether it's going to have what I'll call super biocompatibility. It's one thing to be okay for a wound dressing, but it's a totally different thing to be able to be put into the body and get no fibrous tissue at all. Even many different materials that have been approved by the FDA for different medical devices like silicones and lactic glycolic acid and others get some encapsulation that doesn't impede their performance. And I would expect that probably to be true of chitosan too. Now there may be super chitosans or super chitosan derivatives that might be able to be made where that wouldn't happen, but I don't think that that's been, to my knowledge, has not been achieved yet.
I'm going to go now to a question that looks like it's more for the FDA. So, Dr. Lee, is the approach of the FDA to investigator-sponsored INDs for these novel regenerative medicine programs different than small molecules or biologics? So can you just comment on the uniqueness of the review or the processes at all as compared to small molecules or biologics?
And maybe the person who asked the question could clarify. I'm just kind of wondering what is specifically meant by the small molecules, like more of a the pharmaceuticals kind of things, or?
Correct.
Right. In terms of the IND, the regulatory requirements overlap quite a bit. I think biologics have some additional consideration, like kind of like how I highlighted before, with the different categories like biologics, tissues, and devices. I think a lot of these products, speaking very generally, a lot of these products combine elements of each one. So I think there is a more of a complicated process. It's really hard to answer some of these very without thinking of a specific product. So I think that's about how much I can answer at this point.
Okay, well, thank you. Let me pose a couple of the questions that look like they're for maybe Dr. Jing. Somebody's asked the question about your opinion or perhaps your perspective on a self-assembling peptide and its use for cartilage.
I think the question was mostly on particularly used in cartilage. There have been a lot of literature on the self-assembling peptides for their scaffolding properties. I'm not sure if it can be applicable to cartilage necessarily. It'll depend on what properties are generated when you assemble these peptides, the more of the structural and the strength properties. So it'll all depend on what type of peptide you start with and what's the assembly process. That's probably what I can say. Maybe Dr. Langer has some applications with the self-assembly peptides that he can comment on.
Dr. Langer, do you have any comments on the self-assembling peptide for use in cartilage?
No, I think that's an interesting area. Certainly there have been ones that Xugang Zhang, who's been at MIT, has done. I think it's called Pure Matrix, which I think can be used for, has been studied for a variety of applications, and I think that that's, that's an interesting material.
I think another question maybe for Dr. Jane, Dr. Langer, is how do the speakers see the effectiveness and safety of biomaterials that carry multiple factors that mimic the role of extracellular matrix presenting activators and inhibitors? I guess I'm not sure if they're purely speaking from a scientific standpoint or really in terms of the product development, these more complicated biomaterials that are carrying all these multiple factors. I don't know, it sounds, Dr. Langer, as though you really have the most experience with this, if you want to venture any perspective there.
Yeah, I'm not sure I fully understand the question, though, but I'm happy to try to answer what I can.
The question looked more of didn't quite have a question attached to it, but I'm presuming they're perhaps seeing it as a product development, if there's going to be additional complexities, challenges in moving it through the regulatory pathway.
Yeah, well, of course, we have, I think, some real experts on the regulatory pathway on the phone, so they may be able to be answered better than I can, but I would think, the key thing is to show safety. I mean, that as long as materials are safe, I think that's probably and obviously efficacy too, but when they're combined and, used in any kind of combination, but I would think safety would be the most important factor.
Yeah,
from Dr. Jane, do you have any comments?
Yeah. I was going to add that from a development standpoint, product development standpoint, I think it would be important to have as simple a product as you can possibly develop, more so from just manufacturing itself and then also the testing part of it. But more importantly, from the regulatory approval standpoint, if you have a two-part combination product, it has that challenge. If you start putting in many factors, and each factor you put in would possibly be considered as another combination, so three-part, four-part. I mean, the challenge is multiply and not just add on as you try to figure out which component is important, what is it contributing towards the efficacy, and how are you going to test for it and release the product in the end. That's what I would think having the factors here and getting the outcome is one thing. Getting it made would be a much bigger challenge.
Right, and just to add, I think I might have been indirectly hitting at this point when I was kind of just discussing the cells and the scaffold. I think, you know, just having the right strategy, a combination of in vitro results that you might have, but, you know, more importantly, like, you know, designing the right preclinical models and things like that, you could, you know, probably address this as a whole product rather than, you know, such thinking of it as a very individual component. But, you know, Dr. Jane is absolutely right. Like, the more complexity there are, obviously there are issues that you would have to have some information or data on.
Okay, we also had a question. I think this is for Dr. Langer. You mentioned modification of PGA tubes to cause higher cell affinity and density. What are these modifying molecules? Are they GAGs? Are they others?
Well, I think there's different ways you can do it. You can, you know, I would say that that basically you could do it by adding specific amino acid sequences, and you can also do it by, you know, sometimes affecting the charge. So there's different ways that that you could do it.
And then there was another question, if any of you would like to comment, on the best matrix scaffold choice for facilitating mesenchymal epithelial cell interaction. It sounds like more of a scientific issue. I don't know if Dr. Jane or Langer care to comment on this. If not, we can pose it to the different speakers offline, and if there's any additional comments, we can bring that back on our – we will list these publicly addressed FAQs on our website as well. So we can
– Yeah, I don't know that's Bob Langer. I don't know that there's a simple answer to that kind of question. You know, it may depend on what types of interactions you're talking about and things like that.
Mm-hmm. I think actually I do not see any additional questions other than people want to have access to the slides and the audio. So let me just take a second now just to thank our three excellent speakers. Did a fantastic job, very comprehensive, and I think we're able to address many of the questions and issues that arose about the complexities of moving this type of technology forward. So let me thank the speakers. In addition, I want to thank the participants, the audience that came today. Once again, I just want to reiterate, our intent was really to help inform and help pose some of the complexities and challenges and some of the approaches to moving this type of technology forward into usable products. And I think the speakers did a really excellent job trying to provide some examples and some illustrative ways in which they've addressed some of the complexities. So we are going to have the audio, the slides available approximately 1 week from today. As well, we'll have some of the questions and some of the responses to accompany those questions. In addition, in the next minute, I want to ask those who participated in the audience that we do have a very short survey to solicit your feedback on this webinar, how valuable it was to you, and also we're very interested in hearing about ways we can improve our communications to you. So if you wouldn't mind just taking a minute or two to fill out the survey, we'd greatly appreciate it. So once again, I want to thank the speakers. They did a terrific job, and I want to thank you for joining us today. Thanks very much.